to be in orbit.
What do UFOs, Mothman, time anomalies, and the creative process have in common? In this episode, I sit down with writer and podcaster Richard Hatem, best known for writing the Mothman Prophecies movie, as we explore the strange crossroads of the paranormal and the personal. From government secrecy and extraterrestrial encounters to the dual nature of reality itself, Richard shares how voices like John Keel and Whitley Strieber shaped his understanding of a world that refuses easy answers. And now, onto our interview with Richard Hatem.
To start off, I'd like to ask you to just tell the audience a little bit about yourself, your background, the awesome projects you've worked on, and kind of how you got into writing.
Well, I got into the... In my memory, I would say I started writing in high school. You know, that's when I started writing television. Currently, I am a film and television writer and a podcaster. And, you know, I wrote my first TV script when I was in high school. I didn't sell it, but I was trying. But then I look back, you know, my dad sold his house. I got all this stuff, boxes and boxes of stuff that I had written as a very small child, like a little book I had published. So apparently I've been doing that forever. But yeah, the writing has always been, I think, the major expression of my artistic aesthetic, myself, my desire to communicate with the world. There's also been a little bit of acting, a little bit of stand-up comedy, but mostly the writing. And the writing's been going on for professionally for 25 or 30 years. I wrote The Mothman Prophecies. I wrote co-wrote Under Siege 2, Dark Territory, which many more people have seen, it feels like. And then various TV things. So and now, of course, Richard Hatem's Paranormal Bookshelf, which is the podcast that I write, and that's where I talk about the paranormal books on my bookshelf and kind of what was happening in my life when I read the various books or what they connect to in my life. So it's a storytelling podcast. But well, you know all about it, Dan. You've heard it.
Yeah, I might have heard an episode or two. I guess it's kind of what brought us together, right? I love your show, and I just want to take a beat to say happy one-year anniversary. You just passed the one-year anniversary. How does it feel a year in to reflect now and be like, okay, now I'm a podcaster. How did this go?
It feels great. I have been so lucky. So, you know, like you're a fan of Astonishing Legends, right?
Yes. Great podcast.
So, yeah, and that's the show that launched me. I'd been a guest with Scott and Forrest for like 7 years or something, just on and off, and had such a good time with them. And Scott was always telling me, hey, you got to start your own. You got to do a podcast. And of course, he was telling me, you know, back when, if I had started podcasting when he had told me to start podcasting, I would be doing even better than I'm doing now. But I waited just long enough for it to be an uphill climb. No, but seriously, launching off of their show has given me a huge boost. And so that's, you know, probably started doing it 2 years ago in terms of writing it, and then took almost a full year of writing, editing, recording, finding a composer. Our composer, Nima Kazaruni, who's fantastic, and kind of getting it all set up, getting all the social media set up, the website, and then launching. So when the first anniversary rolls around, it feels like, how could this only be 1 year? I feel like I've been doing this forever. But yeah, it's been 1 year, and I try to remind myself, it's 1 year, and in the podcasting world, 1 year is like 1 week in any other endeavor. It's like, oh, 1 year. Well, tell me when you've been doing it for 10 years, and then let's see how you're doing at that point. So anyway, yeah, but it's great. The audience is great. The listeners are so involved, and I hear from them all the time. It's very rewarding. I kind of love to hear about your experience, but my experience has been the best. This is better than, because you do TV or movies, you may never hear about that. And within a half an hour of launching my first episode, people are writing to me, oh my God, this is amazing, your podcast. You know, how do you know my life? You know, people are like, we had the same childhood. Or, you know, oh my God, I'm going through that too. So the communication with the listeners is what makes it so compelling, because it's like you drop an episode and you hear immediately what people think. And I love that.
Yeah, well, I had a question kind of later on that touches a little bit on that difference between podcasting and, you know, the immediate feedback you get from that versus in the movie world where you know, I guess you write a script and it's almost a year or so before a film goes out and anyone sees what you've been working on, right?
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, I would say now for TV writers and movie writers, in terms of audience feedback, it's probably the best it's ever been in history. Like when I think about the shows that I was watching in the 70s and 80s, I know the people who wrote those shows. And I'm talking about shows that I love, like The Rockford Files, or, I mean, all of you know, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, the Bob Newhart Show, a lot of stuff from the 70s. And I know that those writers felt that they might as well have been writing their scripts and throwing them into a bonfire. Because they knew, it's like, oh, okay, you know, this was our audience share. This is what the Nielsen ratings say. So they intellectually knew that millions of people were watching what they wrote, but there was no way for them to connect with those people. There was no internet. Maybe there'd be some letters. Maybe people would write. At that point, I don't even think people were aware that television shows were written. So I always feel bad for those people, because then a generation later, there's a whole generation of TV writers that are like, oh, I know your name, I know what you do, and you're the reason I'm doing what I do. Except we're doing it at a time when, through Facebook or Instagram or a million different ways, Twitter, people can reach out and go, oh, I saw your episode, you know? And what they're responding to, of course, like, if they're talking to me, for instance, my most recent show is Titans on HBO Max. And I'll write an episode, but I'm writing about these DC characters that people are very connected to. Beast Boy and Raven and, you know, Nightwing. And so when they're commenting, they're like, oh, you know, Nightwing would never do that or something. You know, they're like, They're responding to what the show is, and rarely are they saying, hey, Rich, nice job on the episode last night. I hear them reacting to the episode, but they're not reacting to me, and my voice is being filtered through whatever the show is. And so the big difference, of course, is, you know, my name is in the title of my podcast. So when they're responding, they're responding to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And that in a lot of ways, like you say, it can be a bad side of social media where, you know, when people don't like something, they have a direct connect to you. But also just the positive stuff that kind of comes from things you put into the world. It's a really interesting effect that kind of writing or any creative endeavor kind of causes to happen, where, you know, the world talks back and the art talks back once it kind of hits a certain level out there.
Well, I feel good so far because the people... And it's been, you know, very few, which is nice because it does, you know, I mean, it does make you feel bad. But the people who have gotten in touch to tell me how much they don't like the show, at least they're not liking it for all the right reasons.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Their comments are always like, oh, dude, all you do is... You know, who cares about you talking about your seventh grade girlfriend, you know? And I'm like, oh, well, okay. That's what the show is about. It's about me and my experiences and the books that I read and my opinions. So you hate it for the same reason other people love it. So I'm fine. No one is getting in touch and saying, you know, you profaned the god of my religion and... I am declaring a death sentence. You know, there's no...
You're going to get one of those just this week now.
Yeah, based on this, right? Yeah. Yeah, no one has ever said something where I'm like, Oh, you don't even know what I'm talking about. Except for the only person who religiously listens to the show and I actually think doesn't really get the show is my brother. But he listens because he's my brother and he supports me. But every time he listens, he always comes back to me later and says, yeah, I just don't get it. I don't understand. You had a worse childhood than I did. You know, talking about things. That's not my experience at all. And I'm like, okay, thanks, man.
We should get both of you guys on Astonishing Legends and you can both give your serial order of events and Scott and Forrest can figure out what the real objective truth is, maybe.
Right, right.
That'd be fun. Okay, so now I guess I want to hear your, I guess we could call it a paranormal origin story. Like, how did you go from, you know, dreaming of being a writer to suddenly, I want to kind of lean into the paranormal stuff more that led you to writing something like the Mothman Prophecies?
Yeah, well, it is strange because that's always been an interest of mine. I've always been accumulating these books and hearing stories. I've always enjoyed it, but I never, like my earliest writing efforts for television and for film were not supernatural at all. It was either a thriller or I'd try to write a comedy or an action thing. For whatever reason, I guess I was sort of holding back a little bit. And it was only after I'd made some strides, Under Siege 2 had come out, I was having meetings, people were talking to me about what I wanted to talk about. And sort of in the mid-90s, a few things were happening. I was spending more time in New Mexico, if that's an excuse. And there's such an emphasis in like Santa Fe and Taos about sort of the spirit of the land. And it's a beautiful area. And I, you know, every bookstore I went into, there were, you know, stories and books about things that had happened in that area. Anyway, a lot of stuff was sort of coming together for me, and I was beginning to feel a bit more comfortable talking and writing about that stuff. And I was noticing that the books that I was reading about people who have had strange experiences, they never followed a traditional sort of film narrative. You know, the middle of the story was the best part and the end wasn't, because the middle of the story, when a person is telling you about something that happened to them, they're telling you about the night they spent in a haunted hotel. And the middle of the story is, okay, so this happened, this happened, this happened. And then we went downstairs for breakfast, talked to the manager. He said, oh yeah, people have had weird experiences in the hotel. And we go, oh, that's amazing. And that's the end of the story. You know, there's never any big conclusion. They don't discover, it doesn't lead to anything. But in movies, it always leads to something. It's always, well, the haunting begins, there's something strange, but then the plot takes over. And you realize, oh, it's a murder mystery, or, oh, we've got to, you know, it's trying to kill us and we've got to destroy it. And those elements never happen in real life. I've never heard a story about people staying in a haunted hotel and it turns into a battle for their lives. So I'm like, is there a way to just do a movie where it's just the good middle part? And how can I tell a story like that where a person experiences the paranormal, but then just has to live with the mystery for the rest of their life? And there really were no books to adapt, but I'm telling you, it was within a month of that and that question forming in my mind that I found a copy of The Mothman Prophecies. And that book, I mean, not only is it chock full of strange, amazing things, but it's so cool because it's one of the few books where the strange stuff starts to happen to the author of the book as they're writing the book. So as John Keel was investigating, you know, the various strange events in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, the phenomenon began to notice that he was writing about it and keeping track of it. And so it got in touch with him and he started getting strange phone calls in his motel room, and people would come up to him on the street and say, "Hey, you know, when you called last night, you were so upset, you know, and I'm just checking on you to see if you're okay." And he's like, "I never called you last night." And they're like, "What are you talking about? We were on the phone for half an hour and you were so upset and you just kept asking me what was happening in the town and why was it so strange?" And he's like, "Okay, whoever you were talking to, it was not me." So really weird stuff started to happen to him. And I'm like, that's all really great. And then, of course, in the book and in real life, at the town of Point Pleasant, a bridge collapses. And in retrospect, a lot of people began to feel like sightings of Mothman, sightings of weird lights in the sky, weird precognitive dreams, poltergeist activity, men in black, all of it was a way for the universe to try to warn them that something was going to happen in their town. And that thing was the collapse of the bridge, in which many people who lived in that town died. There was, I think there was over 40 people. And it's a small town. Everyone knew everyone on that bridge that night. And so reading that book and seeing a bit of a structure, I began to conceive of a way to write a story about how the paranormal affects normal people and how we integrate it into our lives as best we can.
When I saw that you'd adapted the movie, and then I was looking through your IMDb, and I couldn't see, you know, a consistent kind of supernatural kind of tilt to your work, but that one stuck out like a sore thumb, you know, Mothman Prophecies. And having read the book, I was like, why would you even try to tackle that book? That's kind of nuts, because it, you're right, it does get to the quality of that middle part of the story. But again, you know, you get to the end of it, and it's kind of like, it's romantic in a way, just trying to kind of go, you know, look, the phenomena is real and it's real. There's magic in the world. And then the end is kind of like, it just stops because, you know, there is no resolution. They don't find Mothman and arrest him for knocking a bridge over or something like that. You know, it just kind of stops. And for me, that ending kind of really, it almost passes the buck to for the viewer to go out into the world and kind of try and experience some of these things for yourself. Were you ever tempted to kind of follow in John's footsteps as part of the like writing process and visit Point Pleasant and go to all those places?
Early on in my 20s and 30s, I really wanted to have an experience. And the idea of just taking a year off and exploring was really appealing to me. Over the years, it has become less so. I'm in a place now where I really don't want to have an experience. I think, you know, I think so many of those experiences leave people pretty destabilized. And look, I'm just, I'm clinging to my stability with both hands. So, I wasn't tempted. And here's the funny thing, Dan, you know, I've never been to Point Pleasant ever. And then a couple of weeks ago, one of the organizers of the Mothman Festival reached out to me and invited me to participate in the festival and be a speaker. And it's so funny because I've wanted to do it for years. It's been going on for a long time. And I kept thinking, I'll do it this year. I'll do it this year. But I never could. And then this year he reached out and I'm like, okay, that does it. That's the sign. I'm doing it. So finally this year in September, I think it's like September 20th, the weekend of the 20th. That's the Mothman Festival in West Virginia. And for the first time ever, I will be there. So all these years later, I'll finally be in the town that started it all. I wrote that script 30 years ago. I mean, well, toward 28, so give or take a couple of years, but and I always thought, I was like, oh, well, I'm going to go. And I never went. And I'll finally go this year.
That kicks ass. I'm really glad you're going to get to go. And you'll get to witness the, they have a wonderful Mothman statue in the street.
Have you been
the
there?
Sculpted, I have, yeah. Elena and I kind of went there. And yeah, the museum's incredible. And oh, actually, while we're on the subject of the museum, I'll ask you. So when I went to the museum, there's a copy of the movie script. In a kind of a glass casing. And on the back of it, there's a note that says, and it was a weird moment for me because it's addressed to Dan, and I was reading it, and I was like, oh, I really want to know the answer to this, because someone had told me that there was something mysterious on the page. And so, yeah, I looked at it, and it said, Dan, the answer to the secret of the universe is on page 173 or something like that. And I've seen a few people have copies of the Mothman Prophecies with things like that written in. And I've always wondered, you know, was John Keel a bit of a joker? Then that page was always blank because I couldn't get in the case to move it to look at the secret of the universe, you know?
That is so it's a note from John Keel, right?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I've got books on my shelf right over there signed by him that, you know, I handed him and said, Mr. Keel, while we were, you know, when I was meeting him and he knew that I was writing the script and that the movie was getting made, and everything in every one of those books is a joke, you know, is his sense of humor. It's like, you know, don't look behind you. They're coming.
That's great.
Yeah. Look, he was a really interesting guy, but what drove people crazy is that he would go to these UFO conferences and stuff, and he would give a lecture, and people would pack the halls because he'd been places and he had seen things, and they were, you know, they were waiting for an answer, and then he would get up there and he'd just start joking about stuff, and people got really pissed off because they're like, no, we want you to tell us. It's so funny. It's like, that's what people want. It's just, no, tell us what to do. It's that weird cult thing. And he refused it. He's like, I'm not your cult leader. I had some experiences. I can't explain them. You should go out and have your experiences. Don't believe people who stand up in front of a crowd and tell you they've got the answers. Because that's where trouble comes from in our world history.
Yeah. There's a website that kind of collects all of his kind of like note cards. And on the website, the subheading is John Keel, not an expert in anything. And yep. I think that's a good approach, right? Especially in this subject where you never know whether someone's trying to sell you a t-shirt or an answer and no one really knows what this is.
No, and it's tough. I mean, that's what made the movie a tough sell, is because even just for a Saturday night, people want to go to a movie and be told the end. You know, it's like, oh, and then at the end, we got the answer. And so the story is concluded and we can all go out and, you know, have a pizza. But because the movie, The Mothman Prophecies, is about one individual, John Klein, facing a mystery and going so far out on a limb trying to solve it for himself that he becomes blind to real life. He becomes obsessed. And it's really the answer of the movie at the end is that he's sort of brought back into the world and realizes, you know, you can only go so far down that road. And you know, pretty soon you're going to find yourself alone in a room with a gun. And whether it's aimed at you or someone else, that's not where you want to go. So it's time now to stop looking into the abyss and start hanging out with Laura Linney, you know, which is the answer to a lot of things.
Yeah, so true. I love what you said about people, you know, being reluctant to search out the experience, because so many people, I see it online all the time in the UFO community, they'll say, I want to, you know, encounter a UFO, I want to be abducted. And the fun version of that is very different from the real life version of that, where it full on traumatizes people. You know, John Mack found that people had PTSD to something. You know, he never definitively said what it was, but they had a reaction to an event. And yeah, it's life-changing and not always in a positive way. Someone in the kind of more esoteric areas of the subject once said to me that in the occult, they have a rule, and that is that everyone wants to see the devil till he shows up. And so it's served me fairly well in the UFO world to be like, yeah, everyone wants to see UFO until they show up and they want to take your, you know, DNA or whatever it is that they do.
Well, you know, so my season 3 of my podcast is coming up later on in the spring. And I start with a 2-part sort of double episode focusing on Whitley Strieber's book, Communion.
Oh, cool.
And you know, I remember reading that book soon after it came out, and I read it again recently to prepare for the episode. And Whitley Strieber is a guy, like, here's a person maybe unique among abductees who, once he began to understand what was happening, rather than crouching down and sort of going into the bunker and praying it didn't happen again, he decided, well, if it's happening, maybe I better lean into it. And he's one of the few people I know, if anyone, who then went out in the woods up at his cabin in upstate New York where the abductions were taking place and basically said, okay, I know what's happening now. It's you know, it's percolated up in my conscious mind. You're out there. You want to talk? Let's talk. I'm inviting you. I'm here. So let's do this, which to me is terrifying, but he did it and they heard him and they continued to engage. Now I'll tell you though, decades later, as he's continuing to write about this stuff, he's very upfront about the fact that even approaching it from that angle, for decades now, going on 40 years, it has not put him in a position of power with the visitors. The rules are still dictated by them. They can come in and out of our reality at will. He has not received a ton of answers, if any. He has not received a lot of cooperation. They have not rolled out the red carpet. It is still a very scary, frustrating, vexing, traumatizing experience for him. And I don't know, I kind of don't know what the final lesson we learn from that. I mean, when you're a guy as smart as Whitley Strieber and you have these experiences, and even you, after 40 years, cannot really provide us with the answers we're looking for, where are we? You know, in terms of that question, I think we're kind of stuck.
I loved how John Keel would talk about a kind of a secret experiencer, that there's usually one person that the event was kind of almost seemed aimed at, and then everyone else was kind of a witness to that kind of taking place. And how he'd always find that one person, and created his kind of, I guess, his informant network, I guess, from the paranormal side of things. You know, he had mediums, he had UFO experiences, everything in between, you know, channelers, and they'd all kind of give him the same messages in the book. That was the kind of one bit of weirdness that stood out to me, that kind of overlap between all the different facets of the paranormal. And Whitley Strieber kind of plugs into that same thing for me, where, you know, he started talking about extraterrestrials, and that was early on. And now when you hear him talk, he talks about the afterlife, and that these beings are somewhere kind of almost more familiar to that term than extraterrestrial. So you've looked through so many different, you know, authors and experiences and stuff like that in your life. And so I kind of want to ask you what you make of these findings. Do you have like an overarching idea or theory for the phenomena itself, or any kind of favorite ideas?
Well, so Dan, I mean, and I think I've told you this off air, you know, I've never had a paranormal experience of my own, nothing that I truly feel, you know, counts. So any theories I have are purely that of the armchair parapsychologist. But I think what's so hard about it, and, you know, I've had conversations with people recently, is that all of these things, I think ghosts and Bigfoot and UFOs, all of this stuff, near-death experiences, everything. What's so difficult about them is that they're not entirely objective or subjective. They're not entirely physical or non-physical. And it would almost be easier if they were completely non-physical, because then you could say, okay, so this stuff, you know, is in a more etheric realm that some people can sometimes tap into. Or if it was completely physical, if there was you know, if someone went out and found a dead Bigfoot body or a live Bigfoot body, but at least bring it back and there it is. The people who are interested in disclosure, who honestly think that there are physical craft being hidden in military bases across America. And why it's only America, I've never understood. They don't seem to be interested in what other countries might have. But it's always, well, America has the answer. The American government made a treaty with the aliens, and there's an alien body in America. It's like, well, what about Russia and China and South America and Europe? Nothing going on there? But okay, whatever. The problem seems to be that it's both. That the phenomenon, again, whether it's cryptozoological or spiritual or ufological, it's both physical and non-physical. And that makes it really, really hard because there is no metaphor. There's nothing that you can say. It's like, well, it's physical sometimes and non-physical, and it can travel in and out of physicality, you know, like blank. Well, there really is no blank. There's nothing else in our lives that people can go, oh, I get it. I see. It's like that other thing. It isn't. But, you know, ghosts are non-physical. You might see one or hear one, but then it's also physical when it's a poltergeist. And Bigfoot is very physical when he's leaving tracks, but then very non-physical when you try to photograph him or get a hair sample. And UFOs are physical when your eyes are burned because you looked at them and now you've got a sunburn on half of your face like Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters. And it's physical when you can see the indentations in the ground in the farm where the UFO landed, but then it's not physical because it disappears and there's no physical proof left behind and the pictures are blurry. So all of these things have dual qualities that in our world that we occupy, we struggle with because we can't pin it down. And we are a Western culture and we are predominantly a materialist culture that believes that science measures reality in all its aspects, but it doesn't. There are many things in our reality that science is simply not a good tool to use to measure it. Our emotions, our memories, our responses to creativity. These are things that science can approach, but not as accurately as it can things that are fed, you know, beneath a microscope and examined in that way. So we're kind of left in this, you know, unending loop of physical, non-physical, physical, non-physical. And I'm not sure when or if we'll ever get out of that loop.
Yeah, it's, you know, whether we're looking at the work of Vallée, Keel, whoever, you know, they all kind of come down on the side of eventually moving away from that extraterrestrial hypothesis to kind of be like, no, that doesn't fit the data. Like, it might fit some of these encounters, but the there and not there aspect of things, you know, if it's a ship from another planet, great, you know, that's what it is. But this seems to go beyond that. You know, there are other mysteries here that just saying ET doesn't solve, that's not an answer. I pulled a quote from Keel. I forget which book it was, but he says, I abandoned the extraterrestrial hypothesis in 67 when my own field investigations disclosed on an astonishing overlap between psychic phenomena and UFOs. The objects and apparitions do not necessarily originate on another planet and may not even exist as permanent constructions of matter. It's more likely that we see what we want to see and interpret such visions according to our contemporary beliefs. And that's interesting because it seems almost like a reflective phenomena, right? It sees us, it changes to blend in.
Right. Well, I mean, that quote you just read kind of encapsulates everything. You know, his ultra-terrestrial theory that yes, this is all Earth-based. And I think there's something to that. You know, it's strange. You'll hear stories about like little chunks of space rocks, you know, hitting various places, little meteors and asteroids. And some of them are huge and some are just very small. But But, you know, they land everywhere. They don't just, they're from outer space. They're physical, but they land everywhere. The government does not have a monopoly on where they're going to, or some knowledge of where they're going to land, or an ability to get there sooner than someone who is not affiliated with the government. And I always think about that when I think about, you know, oh, the government has crashed discs and, you know, alien bodies, everything that the ETH, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, suggests. And yet I keep thinking, well, if a UFO is going to crash, it could crash anywhere. It could crash in Disneyland. You know, it could crash in a, you know, during the Rose Parade. It could crash in a place where many regular civilians would see it and be able to experience it. So where and how are all these UFOs ending up in the possession of the military and the government? And then the suggestion that the aliens themselves prefer to deal with government people is so mind-bendingly absurd and borderline insane.
Well, it's kind of, I think the same with this kind of stuff. You know, if you're coming to this planet, if we just go with the, you know, the nice straightforward extraterrestrial hypothesis, there's life out there, it comes here, it's not going to see our borders. It's not going to look for the White House or 10 Downing Street. It's just going to go to the first person it sees and tries to interact with them. And I'm aware that even when I say that, that's kind of a very human perspective assumption of what another life form will do.
Well, that's like assuming that if you or I walk into a field of cattle, our first thought is going to be, well, where's the head cow?
Yes.
Let me speak to him, and then we'll get back to you. It's like they're advanced. If they're able to come here, and everything we've heard about them is that they're in control. So why they're going to be impressed by, you know, the mayor of the town or the president of the country? I mean, it makes no sense. Now, it makes us feel a lot better. There's probably a lot of people out there whose entire conception of the world is that, well, we're just normal people and the government knows better than us. And of course, those people are always sort of like, well, the government's stupid and nothing works, but they're better than us and they know all these secrets and they've got this stuff that that maybe one day they'll tell us about. And why, again, it literally makes no sense.
Kind of like Schrodinger's government. They're both incompetent and running all things behind the scenes. And kind of can't have one without the other. It's a strange one. Your point about meteors made me think of Charles Fort in the Book of the Damned. He wrote that there was a scientist in France before meteors were discovered who famously declared, he was head of the Astronomical Society in Paris, and he declared, well, there are no rocks in the sky, therefore rocks can't fall from the sky. So that's what science thought of meteors that are now so commonplace. Yeah. I'm fairly sure I got one, you know, in the house kind of thing. And just to think you could take that back 200 years and people would have fights over what it was, just like we do with the UFO stuff now.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we're still trying to figure it out. We're trying to, there's so much we're trying to figure out. And I feel like you'll get much more out of the search if you're not focused so much on a destination or arriving at an answer in your own lifetime that's going to satisfy you. If you're willing to just engage in the process of speculation and research and have fun while you're doing it and enjoy the question, you're going to come away from your experience with the supernatural, I think, far richer than if you're just constantly looking for proof. Because A, proof is hard to come by, and B, when people do come by something they think of as proof, I don't know how much that satisfies. I don't know if they walk away feeling more secure in their life, you know?
Yeah, it almost became a trope in The X-Files, didn't it? The Mulder would find his proof and it would just end up being him sat alone in his apartment with a gun, funnily enough, you know?
Thank you for joining us on this journey through the mysterious and the unknown with Richard Hatem. From haunting tales of the Mothman prophecies to tangled questions of time, free will, and extraterrestrial encounters, this conversation reminds us how much our personal experiences shape our search for truth. In a world where answers remain elusive, it's the connections we make with stories, with each other, and within ourselves that light the way. If you're inspired to explore, create, or simply question, remember, the paranormal isn't just about what's out there, but what it means to be human. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Spotify or on your chosen platform. If you could like, share, or subscribe, that would be very much appreciated. It helps us find our tribe. If you'd like to support the show and get access to a 1-hour live chat each month and early ad-free access, you can find us at Patreon. Just follow the link in the show notes or at our website, tobehumanshow.com. And feel free to reach out via the contact page or email at hello@tobehumanshow.com. You can also find us on Blue Sky, Threads, Instagram, or X at tobehumanshow. As always, remember to be curious. The universe is bigger than we know.
What It Means to Be Human is a Double Barrel production. This week's episode was produced by Roz Mugford and Dan Zetterstrom. Sound post-production by Parker Mosley, with technical support from Dale Mugford. Our theme music is by Thunderbird.